I'm Derek Jensen, this is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Christine McDivitt Tompkins. She's a former CEO of Patagonia. She retired in 1993 and moved to Chile with her husband Douglas Tompkins, where she began her conservation work between Chile and Argentina, of purchasing and putting into permanent conservation a form of national parks, 2.2 million acres. So first, thank you so much for your work, and also thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. Very nice of you.
So let's talk about the Patagonia Park Project. Where is Patagonia? What is the whole project?
Well, the Patagonia region expands across the border between Chile and Argentina, and it's really almost the entire southern cone of Latin America. And it's largely steppe grasslands, and much of which has been degraded by a century of overgrazing, much like you see here in North America.
And so who lives there in terms of non-humans? Who lived there prior to conquest, and what have been the effects of the overgrazing on the wildlife, both animals and plants?
Well, where we're working in Patagonia, all of the original species are intact, but that's a very rare circumstance in the Patagonia region today. Camelids such as guanacos, cougars, foxes, various kinds of small wild cats, colocolos, Jeffrey's cat, no bears, no wolves. They don't come down that far south. But the greatest number of numbers you would see out in the Patagonia steppe today is probably the guanacos, the camelids.
And I don't think that a lot of people, especially in the United States, have any idea what those are.
Well, think about llamas or vicuñas or alpacas. Those are the four, along with the guanaco, the four camelids found in Latin America. And guanacos, out of the three, have the greatest number of wild individuals left. The llamas are practically entirely domesticated, as are the alpacas, and there are wild vicuñas, but not nearly as many as there are in the guanaco family.
And what are the one of the things that you have been working for is protecting large tracts of land. Why is that important?
Well, I think as anybody who reads or anybody in the know realizes that the natural world has been systematically degraded over the last 100, 125 years to a point where we've reached an extinction crisis. Natural systems, whether it's the marine systems or terrestrial, are breaking down. And the non-human species have intrinsic value all their own. So we humans weren't given proprietary use of the planet. And for me, for us, it's been a moral issue. It's almost a religious issue, if I may, to stop this trend and fight against it and try to push back and at least preserve what we consider to be masterpiece landscapes and restore them, not only in terms of their terrestrial species, but also the actual fauna, the species that have been extirpated. We work very hard to try to get those back, in which we, for instance, jaguars in northeastern Argentina, giant anteaters, and so on.
And in the area that, unless I misheard you, in the primary area that we've been talking about, the so far, the most of the creatures are still there. Is that what you said?
So yes. You had to do a lot in the Patagonia Park very specifically, all the original species are still intact. It doesn't mean that their numbers are as high as they should be, but they're there. But there are other areas that we work in where the species themselves have been extirpated, and where that's the case, then we work to reverse that and bring them back.
And how do you, what is your, okay, I'm going to use a word that I don't know if you hate it, but I hate it. What is your management plan for helping creatures to rebuild their numbers? And one reason, before we go on, one reason I hate it is because it presumes that we're actually in charge. And my experience of a lot of this is a lot of times we just need to get out of the way and they know what to do.
Well, I think that's true, but in many cases, of course, that's not true. The species can't come back unless somebody is intent upon making that possible, because you can never reintroduce a species unless you've mitigated the reason they went extinct in the first place, right? So in the case of the jaguar, for instance, in northeastern Argentina where we work, in the Ibirá wetlands, that species has been gone since the 1930s, as have giant anteaters, tapirs, red-shouldered macaws. The list is quite long. So it is. It's a management plan. You have to do tremendous groundwork before you ever commit to reintroduce a species, because it's a huge responsibility, not to mention the costs of doing so. But in the case of the giant anteater, for instance, they have been extirpated from this area, as I said, since the 1930s. So now you want to bring them back. You think, how hard could it be? But you have to understand, what's the ant and termite population in this area today? Certainly things have changed in 85 years. What is the population? How many species of ants and termites are there? What is the threat? What level of threat do you have in the surrounding areas? Is there cattle ranching? Are there dogs? Can you protect them against fire in the grasslands? All of this thing. It takes, even in a species that's fairly straightforward, such as the giant anteater, it took us 3 or 4 years to be prepared. You have to have a quarantine center. Well, that's expensive. Then eventually you start reintroducing the first of their numbers back into the area. Do they do well? Can they fend for themselves? Are they reproducing in the wild? And so on and so forth. So now, 7 years, 8 years after we got started, there are two successful populations, completely independent of us now, functioning in the Ibirá wetlands. But even with a relatively simple strategy as they required, it's still tough and it's expensive, and you got to take the long road. Now on the jaguar, that's a whole nother story. It's complex. You're talking about 1.5 million acres of no conflict zone. You have to really have your stuff together to think you can do that successfully.
What do you mean by no conflict zone?
It means you put a jaguar, you have jaguars, you let them free. This is a vastly oversimplification of what the program is, but anyway, just to cut time short, you cannot put big predators into an area where you know beforehand that they're going to be exposed to serious conflicts, whether it's cattle ranching, whatever it is. Poaching, you name it. So we happen to be in an area with a core of which we own large tracts of land inside the core of this wetlands that is a quote-unquote no-conflict zone. There's no agriculture. There's no ranching. There's no poaching. And then you have a shot at seeing the species begin to repopulate. But if you don't have that, you can forget it. Not going to happen.
So let's go back to the Patagonia Park area.
Yeah.
And in there, do they, who are some of the primary predators?
The predators are pumas or cougars, as they're called here, and foxes. That's really it. And then the small cats. But by far the largest predator is the puma.
And are you having to, you said that the land has been overgrazed, and how has that affected the vegetation, and what are you doing to help restore the grasslands?
Well, really, we're in this particular project, we're talking about roughly 250,000 acres of steppe grassland. So in most of it, the number one thing is just simply taking the livestock off, and in largely sheep. And in some areas, it comes back quite quickly. If there, this landscape has a lot of water systems, quite unusual for the Patagonia region. It has a lot of lagoons, lakes, rivers, creeks. And, of course, in those areas, the grasslands recuperate rather quickly. I'd say in the last 5 years, there are tremendous changes in the structure of the grasslands. But in there are other areas in the same park up toward the Argentine border where the conditions are much more arid, and a small percentage, but still a percentage of the park, I think, will never recuperate. I think they will just be mildly desertified. I think that they're just shattered throughout the Patagonia region. The grasslands are shattered. The percentage of Patagonia steppe grasslands that have been desertified, and by that I mean very rare possibilities for them to come back, is huge. It's at least 20% of the entire area is finished. People have walked off their land because in the early times when the British arrived with their sheep, Argentina was a big producer of wool and meat, and they really were kings of the market, but eventually Australia and New Zealand comes on and they became massive producers of wool and meat, and the Argentine market just fell. There was more worldwide competition. So the price of meat and wool goes down, so the ranchers have to put more sheep on the same number of acres than they did before. And the economic pressures, and this is universal, this is not just in Argentina or Chile, they trash their lands, full stop. And it happened very quickly, in less than 100 years.
So in the United States, one of the problems that anybody attempting to rehabilitate land that's been harmed by grazing, one of the problems that they face is that in the United States, the ranchers are notoriously they hate the natural world, and they hate predators especially. And a few weeks ago, I interviewed Ignacio Jimenez Perez.
Yes.
And he was saying that that where they're reintroducing jaguars, that it's they have a lot of problems, but they actually don't have the problem of that overwhelming hatred of jaguars that there is here with the overwhelming hatred of wolves on the part of ranchers. And
well, he's right about that, but you have to remember that a generation is 25 years. And so if the last jaguars of any number whatsoever were present in the 1930s, so you don't have ranchers today who carry that same fear toward predators because the predators are gone. And it's not to say Corrientes, where we're working, is wildly unusual and that they can't wait for the jaguars to really begin to spread out again across their territory. But that's not to say that individual ranchers aren't going to have headaches from time to time because their livestock will be hit on by predators. And of course they're not going to like it. But the question is, how do you become convinced that living with predators is a fact of life? And in fact, there are a lot of studies coming out about cougars in the United States, which show that if you're a rancher in Wyoming or someplace and you take out individual cougars because they're a menace to your livestock, in many cases it exacerbates the problem because you have new and perhaps several individuals coming into a home range that formerly was organized and pretty well controlled by a single male or just a few pumas. So look, I'm from a ranching family. I'm a fifth generation ranching family, so I understand this stuff. And it is a headache when you get hit on by predators, but it's a fact of life, and nobody has the luxury anymore of just shooting everything because there's a conflict zone. And that's, I think, our job as conservationists and restorationists is figuring out methods that ranchers can use so their reaction is something other than pulling out their guns and their jars of poison and whatever else they choose to use. Because that's what's happening. And it's happening in Africa. It's happening everywhere. What's happening with African lions? Same thing. They're being poisoned because they're a menace. It's a universal problem. It's not the U.S. It's not Chile. It's not Argentina. It's everywhere. There is no accommodation as stress on human communities and individuals rises. Poverty, lack of food, lack of water, the stress levels rise for everybody. I mean, for millennia, people on the continent of Africa got along in some way with predators. Of course, they had to. And this is all falling apart in a fairly recent time. So these are problems that exist everywhere, and they're accelerating. And it's a lot easier to kill a lot more predators today, more quickly than it ever was anywhere. Look at elephant populations. Of course, they're not predators per se, but you can kill a lot of animals very quickly with automatic weapons and helicopters and whatever else is being used.
So why did you choose that area? How will you choose which lands to attempt to restore? How do you make those decisions?
Well, first of all, you have to go someplace you think you can have an impact. And to have an impact, it has to be someplace that you can afford. That is to say that it's not so, the prices for land aren't so prohibitive that you can only buy 100 acres when you need to have hundreds of thousands of acres. So that's one thing. Is it possible to restore an area? What are the, you know, a lot of land conservation is opportunistic. It's not as though you walk in and you have it all planned 25 years ago about where you're going to work and what you're going to do. Because at the scale that we work in, some of it's just plain old opportunistic. And Doug fell in love with Chile in the 60s when he was training as a ski racer. And ended up going back and back and back over the years. So when he sold Esprit and was looking around for a place that called to him, he went back down there. And that's sort of how we got started there. And we both love the Patagonia region. We definitely had that in common.
This is a little bit off the topic of the actual land preservation. But so would you consider yourself a grasslands person? Like, I grew up in Colorado, and so, you know, I know the prairie, but I didn't really feel at home until I ended up here in the forests of Northern California. And I'm really a forest person. Are you a grasslands person?
You know, we live in, have lived in, we split our year between temperate rainforest, Patagonia steppe grasslands, and savanna and tall grass wetlands. And so when I'm there, that's where I am. I am a wildlife person. I am more of the non-human world, perhaps, than the human world. So I work a lot with the reintroduction of species, and I love big landscapes. I love living in isolated places. I am not an urban girl.
So tell me about some of the, we mentioned giant anteater and we mentioned jaguar. What are some of the other species that you have either worked to reintroduce or that you are planning on working to reintroduce to various places?
Oh, okay. So, well, really, Argentina is where we're doing all the reintroduction of species work. In the Patagonia project, there is a deer called the Huemul deer. Looks a little like a mule deer. And there are about 1,700 left in the world. And we are very much a part of trying to protect whatever's left, because the Patagonia park has about 10% of the remaining population. So that's very big on our list. And that's where we got involved with a big puma monitoring project. We're reintroducing Yandu. Actually, I forgot about those. We are reintroducing new populations of Nyandu birds. They're sort of they are of the ostrich family, and you will find them in the Patagonia steppe grasslands. And we are trying to establish three new populations of those. So as I said a few minutes ago, for us, restoration means not the classic restoration of just where there's grasslands, see that there are grasslands again and so forth. But we believe that that means the full complement of the species that were originally there, or at least that are known to us.
And how, before we started recording, you talked about the importance of leveraging for land preservation. Can you talk about that importance for a moment?
Sure. I mean, I hope conservationists everywhere in the world are thinking about leverage as a massive part of their conservation strategy, because I don't care who you are, nobody has enough money to buy the land that we would hope to buy to conserve in perpetuity. I don't care who it is. So you're always trying to take the dollar that you have and maximize its workforce, so to speak. So we're looking always strategically when we're evaluating where to work, where can we leverage up something eventually as we donate it into national park status. How is this a great opportunity in terms of leverage? It's really pretty straightforward.
So for someone who knows that the word leverage, you know, knows what that means in terms of a teeter-totter, but might not know what that means in terms of land preservation, how does that work to leverage one's money into a large,
well, let's or say, efforts? In our case anyway, the only thing I can really speak to, we donated, say, 250,000 acres to the country to form a new national park. And the same time that we're negotiating the donation, we already know that the federal government has a neighboring piece, maybe the same size or larger. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But if it does, part of our suggestion and proposal to the government would be to take that and make a 500,000-acre park. Half is ours that we donate, all in, and half is the government. So suffice to say, it's a public-private relationship that we try to engage in every time we donate something. And there are a few cases where maybe it's not possible, but any place that it is, that's something always to be looking at very carefully.
So let's say I'm a government that has as my primary interest the maximization of foreign exchange and the maximization of tax revenue, etc. How is it in my best interest to how do you argue them to, or how do you convince them, or how do you talk to them about preserving land? Are they generally receptive?
Yeah, you have to remember that where we work, these are pretty isolated places. It's not like trying to build a new national park next to Portland, Oregon. You know, we're working in areas where there are still large tracts of land, privately owned and government owned. And so you don't have the big pressures, the social pressures, the cultural pressures not to do something like that. So if you have a government who has a solidified national park system and they can see the benefits of having a larger park for whatever reason, then they'll be convinced to do it. And where they're not convinced to do it, then they won't do it. But if I lived in the United States and I wanted to work in land conservation, one of the places I would do it is try to look around, do a study on all of the borders of all the national parks in North America and figure out, are there opportunities to increase the size of existing national parks? That's a no-brainer. Because you're adding on to something that is already, in many cases anyway, significant in size, and you increase the possibility of large-scale conservation, which is one of our goals, which is a little different than leveraging, but it sort of comes to the same thing.
Right. And what are some of the obstacles that you've run into that you've had to overcome with both the park projects and the restoration work?
With the restoration work, we haven't had too many conflicts, but certainly when we first got started with Pumalin, which is just under 800,000 acres, we were known as the couple who cut Chile in half, and not in a nice way. We had tremendous, with a particular president of Chile when we first got started, it was completely, was a high conflict zone for us. But then a new president comes in to govern, and, you know, the political winds shift, as we see here in the United States, and the pressures on us began to subside. And also, you have to remember, when we got started, we bought up almost 800,000 acres of pristine temperate rainforest and didn't cut it. So that was a new idea. You know, nobody believed what we said we were doing. And once we built infrastructure and the place was open to the public and there were trails and there was a restaurant and all those other things, then people began to realize that what we said we were doing, we were doing. So it's partly the winds of change, the political change, but it's also just, you know, actions speak louder than words. And we were not an exception to that very old law. So people began to see that we meant what we said. And, you know, now there are tens and tens of thousands of people visiting Pumalin Park every year, and nobody thinks about it one way or the other. It's time. It's experience. It's shifts, political shifts, shifting sands.
Well, that's one of the many things I've so long admired about your work is that you have, I mean, a fundamental radical analysis would, is based on the idea that by changing material conditions, that helps to change political reality. And that's one of the great things you're doing, is changing material conditions, not only, although this is absolutely crucial and primary, not only to help the animals themselves, but then that also changes society.
Yeah, I mean, look at us. We've all been changed by nature. It's not just us, waltzing into Chile. It's our own. We are proof of the pudding, so to speak. We grew up within the National Park Service, not the service, but the national parks in North America. We believe in them. We're part of that petri dish. And it's the same thing with other countries. People start to use their national parks and begin to think about things, even if it's just through recreation. Still, they begin to identify with the natural world, and only through that will they begin to care about it. Because you can't care about anything you don't know anything about or don't understand. So that's a natural process.
What are, can you give a couple of your fondest memories of reintroduction?
Oh, surely it has to be. Well, there are many. That's work that you so gratifying. It's extraordinary, but certainly one of them was when the first jaguar arrived, which resonated throughout the country, and schools closed to go out and meet Tabuna. She was driven through their villages and through the towns to get out to the jaguar breeding center. And it really has been a tectonic shift in thinking about the non-human world for an entire country. That's certainly one. But there are the high notes in species reintroduction are equally the bearers of tough hits on the chin. If you lose a puma in a puma study, that is equally and opposite the joys of having a string of successes, which we have surely enjoyed. But when something goes wrong, you're always aware of the risks involved, but when something happens, it's crushing. So there are a lot of high notes, but there have been a few low notes that are pretty low. But by and large, it's poof. I can't tell you. We discovered a new species, not new species to science, new species to us that everybody thought had been extirpated decades and decades ago in the Patagonia National Park Project. And just 6 months ago, we found a population of not just one individual, but several. So those are pretty extraordinary notes. Just 4 days ago, we realized we found ocelots in the Ibirá wetlands, thought to be extinct since the 30s. So stuff happens out there that you don't know about. We know very little. I don't care who it is. We know so much less than we think we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm doing a very, very small bit of reintroduction here. There's a plant called Western Lily, who is very, very rare. There's only like five populations left, and they're trying to reintroduce them. They're trying to grow them in a nursery to reintroduce. And I know one of the people associated with that, and I was begging them for one for years because there's some good habitat here. And they finally gave me a very sick one that was actually that was growing and literally growing in a trash dump. And I grew it through last fall, and then it died, and I was heartbroken. And then this spring, it's sending up new roots. It ends up that it actually wasn't dying. It just had died back.
Well, see, now that's a microcosm of what species reproduction is like every day. Every time you think that you're on your way to something, something happens to an individual, and then something else happens, and you realize that you now have two great independent thriving populations of baby anteaters. But simultaneously, a baby anteater dies in the quarantine because it came in so diseased or so beaten up by a dog or however, whatever his circumstances were. So that's exactly, if you take the Western lily and multiply it by hundreds and hundreds of events, that's about what it's like.
And how does all of this relate to the notion of deep ecology?
It's completely related to it because, at least for me, deep ecology, if you synthesize it down, just down to RNA's original sort of basic thinking, to me it is that all life, all beings have intrinsic value all their own. They don't need humans to place value on it. And that you must have abundance and richness in a healthy world, and anything that works against that, whatever it is, falls out of line with that possibility. So everything we do is really built on deep ecology structure and thinking. It doesn't mean we're always successful, but it is absolutely true that that's what we're shooting for.
So, what do you want? What do you want for the Patagonia Park area? What would be over the next 10 years, say, what would you would be happy if you saw this in that area?
I would be happy if the government moves ahead and declares the donation a national park and includes the neighboring federal land into that, which would add up to about 650,000 acres. I will be happy that the ranches around the park find new management systems for their sheep herds, as we're trying to do with Great Pyrenees dogs and everything else. I would be happy that the neighboring towns find that the national park is a good neighbor and creates destiny and health and dignity for their individual lives and support their park. I'm always looking at things 100, maybe even 200 years out. And in order for that to happen, then a lot has to happen now. And one of it is that the park will be long forgotten that it was a Tompkins who created that park. That's the least of our worries. What we want is that 150 years from now, 200 years from now, it's still a national park and it's being wildly defended by the communities around it. That's what I want. And I want people to understand the value through having visited these parks and the rest of our parks, the value of the non-human world, and that they have a moral obligation to share it in a way that all beings can flourish. That's what I want.
Well, which is one of the things that I have always loved about your work is, a comment I've made at a lot of my talks is that a lot of environmentalists, and I'm not talking about you here, I'm talking about more shallow environmentalists, I guess, is that a lot of them, I'm not sure that they're clear on what they want. Do they want smaller clear cuts or kinder clear cuts or what does they want? And I've always said that I'm very clear on what I want, which is I want for there to be more wild salmon every year than the year before, and more
Exactly.
songbirds. And that's one of the things that I just love about your work is that, you know, it's you didn't say these words, but it's very clear that what you want is for there to be more giant anteaters every year than the year before.
Of course I do. We wouldn't put hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars into this and our own thousands of hours and this and that and all the people, Ignacio being one of them, work like a dog on these things if we didn't want more and more and more of these fabulous individuals there than are today. That's the whole point.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and let's say that someone, how can people help with either that specific those specific projects there, or how can they help replicate these things in other places on scales large or small? What do you want for people who listen to this interview to do?
Well, first of all, I think if they want to be involved in the Patagonia Park or the species reintroduction, a great and rather callous thing to say is that they join us financially and make contributions to the work and come and visit and see how it's done. We love visitors. So that's sort of on the surface. But I think the main thing is that people need to get out of bed every day with a commitment to do things about those things they love. And don't make any excuses about, I don't have the time, I don't have the energy, I don't have the money. Listen, there are people out there working in circumstances extraordinarily difficult with a fraction of the financial resources that we have enjoyed over time, and they get a lot done. So people have to get up and go do something. First of all, they have to decide that their life is worth more than what they're doing with it right now, and go protect those things you love. Go protect those things that have no voice of their own. That's what I would say.
Well, a couple of things. One of them is that my book Endgame, when people ask me to sign it, I always sign it, find what you love and defend your beloved. And I think that that's part of it. And then the other part that I love about what you just said is that there's a friend of mine always says that the big difference is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who don't, or those who believe in this sort of action or that sort of action. But the big difference is between those who do something and those who do nothing.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think a lack of commitment to just throw yourself into something is, and so I don't have any patience for that. I mean, we're running against the clock here, and we all know it. I don't care if you're a senator who doesn't believe in climate change, or you're just somebody who, I don't know, wants to go grab a coffee in the morning instead of running out and get to work. I don't see the patience for it. I think that we don't have time to imagine our lives doing something other than, you know, taking care of our families, going to our jobs, but doing something to protect the non-human world. I don't see it.
I don't either. You know, especially people oftentimes will say, oh, the problems are too big, or it's too late, or they'll say this or that. And it's like, look, with what's at stake, it doesn't even matter.
It doesn't matter.
Odds are you have to do what you can do.
Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But shame on you if you consider that doing nothing is an option. Well, then you get what you deserve. I don't care what it is. That's how the world works. You don't see the Tea Party people out there saying, well, I just don't think I'll waste the time to defend what I think is right or wrong. You know why they're gaining so much ground? Because they're doing just the opposite. They care about their beliefs and they're going after them. Well, everybody should. What else are you going to do with your life? Sit on your toes? I just don't believe it. I don't agree with that.
Well, if you could have listeners to the interview take away one thing that they know, and I think it's going to be pretty clear, but if you could have them take away one thing that they know for sure and that changes their lives, what would it be?
Oof. I really believe what Margaret Mead said. I don't know when she said it, but she said all revolutions start with one person. And so people who say, oh, they're not going to make a difference, whatever it is, I just don't believe that. So I love the quote by Mary Oliver, the poet, and it's forgotten the name of the poem, but the last line is something to the effect of, tell me what it is you'll do with your one wild and precious life. And that's kind of my personal motto.
Well, I hope that, and I've said this to you in a private email, but I'll say this to you in public too. I hope you know how much the jaguars and the anteaters and everybody else appreciates your work.
Well, thank you, Derek. That's very kind of you. And it's not my work. It's not the Chris and Doug show. We have extraordinary people working with us, and they really know how to put the hammer down and get a lot done, and they're serious. So yes, they're really the authors of a lot of this work.
Well, thank you for helping to put them in a position where they can be the authors then.
Okay.
And I would like to thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Christine McDivitt Tompkins. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.